if you are ready to proceed, and would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, 6 minutes, please.
Okay, very good. Thank you. You may go forward.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jim Childress. I represent Franklin Thomason. What I brought forward to this court is really two assignments of error. One is, just so the court is aware, is the sentencing argument, or basically an Eighth Amendment disproportionality argument. I understand the case law is vast and is adverse to my position. So I'm just going to rest on my brief, if that's okay with everyone. So I'm going to focus my time on the other assignment of error, which is a request to withdraw the defendant's guilty pleas and the court's denial of that motion.
Let me kind of start you off, if I can, on that, because we've got some recent case law.
Yes.
And I know you didn't cite at least one of the cases in your brief, and maybe because it's so recent that it wasn't out at the time you filed your brief, but that's the Small case from the Virginia Supreme Court.
Yes.
I guess, you know, Harris and Justice, the two seminal cases for the Supreme Court on withdrawing guilty pleas prior to sentencing, deal with straight-up guilty pleas. The Hubbard case out of our court, which was cited by the Supreme Court in Small, I think Hubbard actually also was a straight-up guilty plea, but there's some language there that talked about how the situation might be different with a plea agreement, and Small dealt with a plea agreement situation, as does this case.
Yes.
And I guess my question would simply be, given Small, which I gather you are familiar with, but
yes,
but the holding there was that if the Commonwealth is prejudiced, then it may not be appropriate to withdraw a guilty or to allow withdrawal of a guilty plea, even if the standard of having a defense is met. In this case, the record is that the Commonwealth dropped some charges and has also proffered for the record that two of the witnesses could not be located, at least at the time of this hearing. Why doesn't that satisfy the prejudice requirement of Small, and which would obviously mitigate against your position here?
So I have a twofold argument on that. One is that the court has the authority to look at this in the totality of the circumstances. So simply the null processing of charges doesn't per se say that there's prejudice. Now, the court says they may. That is a factor for the court to consider.
Well, no, I think this is one point, which is that unlike a straight-up guilty plea, in a plea agreement, we have a contract situation. We have an agreement,
yes,
between the parties. And in return for some consideration by the Commonwealth, in this case dropping some charges, the defendant gets, you know, a benefit, and the Commonwealth gets a benefit. They don't have to put be put to the test of putting their evidence on and so forth, and saves the taxpayers a bunch of money along the way,
yes,
as well. So, you know, when you have a contractual arrangement like that, it seems to be Small stands for the proposition that, you know, you don't lightly permit the undoing of what amounts to a knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered into contract.
Yes.
And so I'm going to have to deal with that aspect of Small as well.
And that's a hard part of this case for the appellant, for sure. But that is also, again, not a per se issue. The trial court actually said that contract principles do apply, and that the court was really granting specific performance and saying that you are bound by this contract, you are going to follow through with this contract. And I think other cases have said that. I think it's the Griffin case and the Goodman case that I cited also say that. And the court held them to that plea agreement. But in this case, we have a little different circumstance. I'm not aware of any cases where after someone has gone through the discovery process, believes they know all the existing exculpatory information, agrees to this certain plea agreement, knowing what they know at that point, and then at some point a new witness comes forward and says, I have information that's relevant to this case. And I think, but for that new witness, I wouldn't be here at least on that one particular issue. So that new witness is what's precipitated this entire appeal and motion to withdraw and the court's denial of that. And if we go back to the Small case, I think, really was decided on several other issues, not necessarily just the written plea agreement and the waiver of being able to withdraw. In that case, there was an issue where he says he was not given, I think, proper legal advice, gets another attorney, similar to the Justice case out of Grundy. And then when he was denied that, he says he had a reasonable defense, but he had that reasonable defense back then. But at the time that he made that motion, I think it was 4.5 years or something is what the Small case says, after he after the incident that caused that particular charge, and it was 3 years after his particular guilty plea. So when you look at it in that time frame, and that's a vast amount of time, that who knows what's going to happen. So the trial court in this case said the Commonwealth was prejudiced, I think partly because those two witnesses the Commonwealth proffered, that they weren't able to find them. But those were not witnesses that they needed for their case in chief. I don't think there's any evidence that that's the case.
Well, if I understand the record in this case correctly, this newly discovered evidence is arguably materially inconsistent statement that the eyewitness, the girlfriend of the victim, gave to a third party. And I think what the trial court also had before it was this third party couldn't recall exactly when she said what she said, right. The details of what she said, and it said basically it was because I was on a lot of drugs at the time. That was
right.
the witness. And then on top of that, the statement was along the lines of her indicating that the victim had threatened robbery, which led to an altercation where I guess they were fighting over the gun, and the gun discharged and killed her boyfriend. But I also note that the record reflects that your client gave a statement that was actually consistent with the first statement the eyewitness gave, and inconsistent with the statement of this newly discovered witness. So, I mean, is the trial court permitted to consider basically credibility findings and making a determination about whether this is one of those circumstances where the Supreme Court would arguably permit you to withdraw a guilty plea, or is it?
So there are really two issues that factors on. One is whether the motion is filed essentially frivolously and essentially to manipulate the court, and whether this person pled guilty in order to delay time. And I believe that was the Paris case. I'm not sure off the top of my head, but there was one case that I cited that they pled guilty in order to buy time. And that's what that particular element for under the Paris and Justice line of cases is saying. But the court, when determining whether this person is credible or not, I would say really doesn't have a bearing. It's up for the trier of fact. And this court in Hubbard says as long as there's some sort of reasonable basis for a defense, then the guilty plea should be allowed to withdraw. Of course, we still have the separate waiver argument. I know that's a hurdle. But regardless, when we're talking about whether that's a reasonable defense or not, the Hubbard case doesn't say, do we think this case is going to be go the other way? Are they going to be found not guilty? That's not the test for the court. The test for the court is to determine whether there is something in the record that would show that there is some sort of reasonable defense available to this appellant. And in this case, I understand my client's given inconsistent statements, and there's no denying that. And
none of which are, by the way, are consistent with what this newly discovered witness says.
That's true. However, it is clear from the record that the appellant's version was going to be self-defense, and I put that on the record at the motion to withdraw. There was also a motion in limine filed by the Commonwealth to prevent that, because they said, well, if you're not going to testify, we don't want that coming in because you can't. It's an affirmative defense, of course. But that was going to be our defense, self-defense. And if you believe this new witness, Andrew Palasia, that one of his statements, although he had credibility issues, but he says the decedent is the one who brought the gun to the defendant appellant's home, and that he had approached the appellant with the firearm with the intent to rob him, and there was a struggle, the gun went off, and the decedent is the one who died. Now, that sounds like self-defense. And I would say not only is that a credibility issue for Amy Grubbs, who's the Commonwealth's eyewitness, but also it corroborates the defendant's self-defense claim. And in order under Hubbard to be a reasonable defense, it just has to be something supported on the record.
And if this were a straight-up plea, that might be a great argument. I guess the question I have is simply, does the small change that equation where you've got now a contractual arrangement?
Right.
You know, it seems to me the burden is at least arguably a lot higher than it was, you know, if it's a straight-up plea.
It makes it tough, and I've acknowledged that, and I'm not sure how to get over that other than other possible contract remedies. If one person's going to breach, the other person's going to be allowed to breach, get back into whatever position they were at before.
Except the Commonwealth can't, at least the record reflects, the Commonwealth can't get back into the position it was in before because they can't find two key witnesses that were available earlier.
Well, if I can touch on that for a second. So those two key witnesses, they were not in the Commonwealth's case in chief. Those were witnesses that were brought forward to the attention of the Commonwealth through that new witness, Andrew Palasia, that came forward. And under Defendant's Exhibit 1, there was a CD that's in the appendix that's been filed. Those people, I think one was interviewed and the other was not. We weren't able to find that person. But Andrew Palasia, the new witness, says that Amy Grubbs, the eyewitness of the Commonwealth, made these statements in front of these other people. So they wanted to be able to corroborate or disprove this new witness's statements. So they are not someone who they intended to introduce at trial. This is a new witness that's come forward based on this. And I would submit, based on the timing of sentencing by motion, I don't know how much effort they put into that, but they did say on the record they weren't able to find them. However, you know, how much work they did, I just don't know the answer to that. But if we're going to put them back to the same position they were had he pled not guilty, those witnesses were not part of their case in chief. That's rebuttal evidence for the new witness. And at the end of the day, when you have to, well, I would suggest there has to be some sort of remedy for someone where newly discovered evidence comes forward. And if this new evidence comes forward and they've signed this contract that but for knowing about this, they would have gone through with it. There's just no remedy other than under 192.296 to file this motion to withdraw. I understand the court held him to specific performance, but we're really hoping that we can breach that. The court is going to find that there's been an abuse of discretion and that this case is going to be reversed and remanded. And unless there's other questions, I'll save my rest of my rebuttal.
You may. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Ms. Yates.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am not Craig Stallard. I'm Rachel Yates. I'm appearing on his behalf today.
We received his letter. Thank you.
Thank you. Your Honor, the court in this case did not abuse its discretion in denying Mr. Thomason's motion to withdraw his plea. The trial court based its decision on three different things. The first being that the Williams case forecloses attacks on victims' credibility as a basis to withdraw one's guilty plea. The second,
well, let me interrupt you, Ms. Yates, that
yes, sir.
Your opponent asserts, and you heard me ask him the question, whether the, in this case, the trial court based at least a lot of its decision on the fact that he didn't find that this new Mr. Palacio, the new witness, was credible. Is that appropriate for the court to base a decision on whether to withdraw a guilty plea on a credibility assessment?
Not as to the existence of a reasonable defense, Your Honor. But the trial court could certainly take credibility into account in determining, as my opposing counsel, I believe, indicated, in terms of whether this was frivolous, whether this was made in good faith, and in terms of whether the last part of the equation, which is the but for whatever this is, whether it's undue influence, et cetera, whether it's just entering into a plea inadvisedly, the court could take witness credibility into account in determining that. Otherwise, the trial court specifically indicated it was basing its decision on those three things. I'd also, in terms of this first issue, this Williams issue of impeachment evidence, it was explicitly indicated to the trial court that this would be an impeachment witness. And as the Commonwealth attorney to the trial court articulated, it could not be used as substantive evidence in terms of the truth of the matter. So it's only limited to impeachment. And Williams does foreclose that as an avenue for attack on a trial court's denial of a motion to withdraw. Second, there was prejudice to the Commonwealth in this case. And Mr. Thomason indicates that, well, the two missing witnesses that the Commonwealth proffered...
Well, let me stop you, because I think what you just said just finally registered with me. Is the Commonwealth's position then that Mr. I'm probably pronouncing his name wrong, Palasia?
I believe it's Palasia, but...
Palasia. Mr. Palasia's evidence, because it's in the nature of impeachment evidence and not substantive evidence, and only goes to impeach the credibility of the eyewitness... That does not constitute a defense, then? Because I thought you earlier conceded that it did or would, but I thought I understood you to say since it's only impeachment evidence, not substantive evidence, it could not be introduced as evidence of actual self-defense, if you will.
I apologize if I'm misunderstanding the court's question in response to the court being confused by me. So let me try to be more articulate. It is the Commonwealth's position that Mr. Palacia's testimony, if testified to at trial, would only be offered for impeachment purposes. That would be the only way that it is admissible.
So if it were a jury trial, the jury would be instructed they could not consider that as substantive evidence of self-defense.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
In terms of prejudice, Mr. Thomason argues that the two missing witnesses that the Commonwealth proffered to the court, they could not find. The two missing witnesses were not relevant to their case in chief, but to the extent that if what the court is being asked to do is to allow Mr. Palacia to testify, then the Commonwealth is certainly entitled to impeach the impeachment witness. So that is a correct, fair factor for the court to have taken into account in terms of prejudice. Separately, also indicative of prejudice, the trial court noted in this case that the plea itself was entered the day before the jury trial. And that factored into the court's prejudice considerations, in addition to the null pros of the malicious wounding charge and the reduction to the second-degree murder in this case. Lastly, the contractual issue is fairly straightforward. In this case, Mr. Thomason agreed, pursuant to a plea agreement, to waive his right to withdraw his guilty plea. The trial court asked and a perfectly appropriate plea colloquy. If he'd read and understood the terms of the plea agreement, he said he did. He indicated he could read and write, and he had no questions. So the trial court made a finding that the plea agreement was, he was going to accept it, endorse it, and that this was a free and voluntary plea. So for those reasons, it's the Commonwealth's position that the trial court did not err or abuse its discretion in denying Mr. Thompson's motion in this case. As to the second assignment of error, the Commonwealth will also rest on brief unless the court has specific questions about that, or if the Commonwealth can answer any other questions of the court.
No, thank you, Ms. Yeh.
Thank you.
Mr. Childress.
Thank you. So I just want to go over the factors in justice in Paris again, because and maybe we're confusing some of the issues with this newly discovered evidence with some of these factors. The cases say that the three factors, and just kind of put it in general terms, is there a reason to withdraw so that there's no manipulation of the court? Two, is there a reasonable defense? And then three, is the Commonwealth prejudiced? And those are the things that the court must consider when determining whether to withdraw. Now, the cases don't apply the reason for the withdrawal to the defense. So the defense itself in this case, and we've proffered that it's going to be self-defense. Now, this to say that this new Palacia witness doesn't go to the self-defense, I don't think that has anything to do with the cases. It just doesn't have merit based on what the cases say. So if Palacia is the reason for the withdrawal, the defense was always self-defense. Now, it helps. It corroborates in one of his statements, the self-defense claim, but it is not entirely the defense. And that's not what any of the cases say. So, for instance, in Smalls, he said he was given bad advice by his lawyer and had a good defense. Now, he had that defense the entire time, just like Thomason has had this defense the entire time. Now, of course, he's given inconsistent statements. The jury may not believe that at the end of the day, but that's not what the court in Hubbard said. As long as there's some reasonable basis for to take this case to the trier of fact and let the jury decide it.
Well, I think the problem is, of course, Hubbard I'm very familiar with. I wrote the opinion in
right.
Hubbard. So, but the Hubbard was not a plea agreement case.
Yes.
But Hubbard raised the possibility that the standard might be different if there were a plea agreement where the Commonwealth would be prejudiced. Supreme Court picked up on that language. They cited Hubbard and Small. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to read Small, frankly, in my humble opinion, as essentially saying that the whole Paris justice, you know, line of Hubbard line of cases, you know, that stand for the proposition that a defendant should be allowed to withdraw their guilty plea if they advance a reasonable defense, kind of goes out the window if you've got a plea agreement where they've, you know, knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered into a contract with the Commonwealth has honored its end of the contract, and they're expected to honor their end of the contract. And so, you know, to the extent that there's any prejudice to the Commonwealth by withdrawing the guilty plea, I think Small stands for the proposition that, notwithstanding the fact that you got a terrific defense that you've come up with from newly discovered evidence or whatever, you know, you're SOL, essentially, if you want to, you know, try to advance that where there's been a contractual arrangement with the Commonwealth who's going to be prejudiced by doing so. And I think that's what the hurdle you have to get over, quite honestly.
And that's what I'm trying to avoid. So, and the prejudice...
Well, I don't think you can avoid the hurdle. I think you've got to find a way to get over it.
Right.
Well, get over it.
So the prejudice to the Commonwealth, the trial court cited really two things, and it was the issue with the two witnesses, but they were not in the case in chief, and then the Commonwealth null price charges. And there are cases that say the court can say, in the totality of the circumstances, null pricing charges is enough for prejudice to the Commonwealth. However, in this case, I guess we're asking the court to carve out an exception then for when there's newly discovered evidence that but for this new evidence, you would not have entered in that plea agreement. So I don't think I can argue that it's not an arm's length contract because there's no, I know all those guys personally, they're not going to hide evidence or anything like that. It's just evidence that came forward, unfortunately, a day late and a dollar short. So when that happens, what do you do? And if hopefully you're not SOL, as the court has said.
It's a legal term.
Right. Maybe that'll make it into the opinion. So.
Counsel, you need to wrap it up. Your time is
okay, thank you. I think I've gotten my point across, and we're asking for reverse and remand. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel. We'll come down and greet counsel.